You are Locked On Dodgers, your daily Los Angeles Dodgers podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
So I say D, I say D-O, D-O-D, D-O-D-G, D-O-D-G-E-R-S, team, 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 team.
Hello, Dodger fans. Welcome to Locked On Dodgers, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one local sports daily podcast network. Locked On, your team every day. This is the daily podcast covering the Los Angeles Dodgers, bringing you the smart fans' perspective on our boys in blue. I am Jeff Snyder of Baseball Essential, along with Vince Samperio of Chavez Ravine Fiends. Vince, how are you?
Jeff, I'm doing well. No good news, but also no bad news. So we're at neutral for the day.
Yeah, I guess so. Although maybe a day with no news is by default bad news right now, since the current situation is bad. But yeah, no worse news, I guess. So we'll take whatever we can get, I guess.
Yeah.
Today we're going to answer a couple listener questions, and then we're going to talk about the 1998 season, kind of inspired by the documentary from this weekend about McGuire and Sosa's home run chase in 1998. So that's the plan for today. First, we want to remind you, please subscribe to Locked On Dodgers wherever you get your podcasts. And when you get in your car or sit on your couch, tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On Dodgers. All right. Any preamble before we jump into our mailbag, Vince?
No, we put it out kind of late, so, you know, maybe didn't get the questions we thought, but there's also not a lot of questions left to ask these days, so, yeah, I'm ready to get into it.
Yep. All right, our first question comes from Brian Williams at Elephant Party. That's a cool Twitter handle. He says, I heard on a local radio show yesterday that the National League will now have the DH in 2021. Is this true?
Yeah, I haven't personally seen that reported, but I'm not going to say that it hasn't been reported, but it might have just been talk radio, kind of like how we talk about hypothetical situations. But either way, I guess it could be possible if somehow 2021 is also affected like 2020, or if there is no 2020, it's very possible that they could try to get the DH for 2021, although it likely will come full time. Yeah, when they renegotiate the CBA after the 2021 season.
Yeah, it's, we've talked about it kind of with regards to the expanded playoffs. I said it's hard to picture them going to expanded playoffs and then going back, since they wanted expanded playoffs anyway. And I kind of feel the same way about the DH in the National League. If there is a 2020 season, there will be the DH for this season. And there's been momentum towards a universal DH anyway, and so it's kind of hard to picture them going back. But like you said, that's a CBA thing, and there's still, 2021 is still under the old CBA. So the only way it would really – I don't think that's something that Rob Manfred has the power to institute unilaterally. Even if it would be something that he has to give a year's notice, and he hasn't done that. So the only way I could see it happening for 2021 would be if the owners pull their heads out and actually remember that they and the players are on the same side of trying to play baseball and make money, and actually if the relationship repairs enough that they're having conversations, I could see them maybe even hashing out the CBA a year early or something. But right now, with where the relations are, it's hard to picture anything positive happening. And so I would guess that 2021 rules will be status quo.
All right, next question. I'll let you answer this one real quick, since, and then we'll go to the other question. But from Alejandro at Alitz99, he asks, where and when, which has become a rallying call of sorts for MLB players, basically telling the owners and Manfred where and when to show up for the season.
Yeah, it's a really smart thing the players are doing, because Manfred always said, hey, you guys need to negotiate, or I'm just going to use my commissionerly powers to decide how long the season's going to be and when it starts. And they called his bluff. They said, okay, where and when? And he said, oh, well, what's your hurry? I didn't mean literally, you know, gap tooth moron. Anyway, I have a gap in my teeth, so I'm allowed to say that. Just like fat people are allowed to make fat jokes about other fat people. Players call their bluff. But Alex, unfortunately, the answer right now is nowhere and never. But hopefully we'll get better news soon.
All right, since that one wasn't a real question, we'll get on to our last question from, well, I know it's Tatiana, but at Nerdy Dodger, she says, you know, if they don't have a season, the Dodgers, you know, won't get Mookie, he'll become a free agent. But if there was no season of play, would there be some kind of legal way that would only have the contract valid during a playing season, therefore 2021, if there is no season in 2020?
Yeah, and you know, you and I talked about, this is actually the first thing you and I talked about during the COVID thing, Vince, on our show on Friday, March 13th, because on Thursday the 12th is when they shut down spring training, and you and I did an episode. I was sitting in the front seat of my car in a rainstorm at a baseball tournament, and I remember us talking about, and the first thing we talked about was the ramifications on the Mookie Betts deal, and our point then, which has kind of been borne out, is there is no fair answer, because the one way, keep just saying contracts all just bump back a year isn't fair to the players, isn't fair to the players, but the other way isn't fair to the owners and the teams. But unfortunately, there is nothing, and that was something that they hashed out in the March agreement, was that if there is no season, everybody who got a year of service time last year gets a year of service time this year. And so that's been agreed on, and there is no legal recourse, as far as I know, even if the Dodgers were inclined to try to take it. Their only real option is to just sign Mookie to an extension, which I think is likely anyway. I don't know who else would pay him what he's worth in these conditions. The Dodgers were going to have an advantage anyway, and I think they have an even more advantage now. But no, unfortunately, there is no loophole to be found that would say, oh, we get Mookie for another year.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it would really depend on how that agreement in March, you know, if it's on paper. You know, the other agreement that they had was that they would get paid prorated salaries, and that's kind of the big argument right now. But on the other side of it is, I'm not sure how many, you know, there's not a lot of players that are going to be fighting for that to happen, where the, you know, that all contracts kind of go back to 2020 if there's no season for 2021. And there's not a lot of owners that are going to fight for that. You know, there's some owners that would get contracts that they didn't want to pay off the board, and they don't have to worry about paying them anymore. There'd be some players that, you know, weren't getting, maybe, I don't know. There's not really anyone that would argue for that side other than, you know, us as fans wanting to for sure guarantee that Mookie gets to play with the Dodgers. So that's probably the, well, other than if it's already written down legally and everything. But the other part of it is that, you know, there's not really anyone going to fight for that necessarily.
Yep, absolutely. I think that'll do it for the mailbag. Thank you guys for your questions. Like Vince said, it was a late call. We just needed a couple questions because we had our 1998 segment all set. So thank you, and we'll do another mailbag maybe even this week. So feel free to shoot your questions over anytime on Twitter, you know, either at us or DM us or whatever. We'll give you all the information at the end of the show if you don't already know it. But now let's talk about Postmates. Postmates is a service that will bring you stuff. Vince, a week or two ago, I was telling you about the microwavable burritos from the gas station. Do you remember that, Vince?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Did you know that Postmates will go to the gas station and buy you a burrito and bring it to your house and leave it on your doorstep, and you could put it in your very own microwave or oven?
Yeah, I did not know that specifically, but that's good to know.
So if you need a good burrito, it's called The Bomb. There's three different flavors. There's a green one and a red one that I really like, both of them. I haven't tried the Chipotle one. It's in a blue wrapper. But the two I've tried are just amazing. And seriously, you don't have to get in your car and drive to the gas station yourself. Postmates will go get it for you and leave it on your doorstep, because what Postmates does is they go get whatever you need. If you need a hamburger from In-N-Out, they'll go wait in the In-N-Out drive-thru for you. I don't know if they wait in the drive-thru, but they'll get you whatever you need from wherever you need it, a burger, a pizza, some sushi, whatever, or a burrito from a gas station. How amazing is that? So Postmates, maybe you've gotten used to these last couple of months never leaving your house, and maybe you think, you know what, this is kind of the life for me. Guess what? Postmates can help you make that happen. Even if you do have to leave the house and you just get home and you've already put on your sweatpants and taken off your shoes, and then you realize you need a burrito from the gas station, this is all hypothetical. I'm not talking from experience. Don't judge me. But Postmates won't judge you. They'll just bring you stuff, and they'll leave it right on your doorstep so you don't have to talk to a person even. They have whatever you need. They also do Postmates pickup, so you can order through Postmates and then just run and pick it up yourself. If you want to do that, support your local restaurants who obviously need our support at this time. All you have to do is just download the Postmates app on iOS or Android, find your favorites, and get anything you want delivered within the hour. For a limited time, Postmates is giving our listeners $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days. To start your free deliveries, download the app and use code LOCKEDON. That's code LOCKEDON for $100 of free delivery credit in your first 7 days when you download the Postmates app. Anything you need, including gas station burritos, anytime you need it, including right now, Postmate it. And keep it locked on, Dodgers. All right, Vince, are you ready for perhaps the most obscure of all obscure former Dodgers?
I'm actually excited, so yes, I am ready.
Okay, I was thinking, for some reason, about the 1955 Dodgers. It was the first Dodger team ever to win the World Series. As you know, of course, Tommy Lasorda pitched one game for that team. That was Sandy Koufax's first year on the team as an 18-year-old. And so I looked at those Dodgers, and I looked to see who was the player who wasn't a pitcher who had the fewest plate appearances for the 1955 Dodgers. And that answer was Burt Hamrick, H-A-M-R-I-C. Burt Hamrick, it was a 27-year-old. He made his major league debut on April 24th, 1955, as a pinch runner in the bottom of the 10th inning. The Dodgers were, holy crap, 10th inning, so that means it was tied after 9 innings. In the top of the 10th, the Giants scored 6 runs. So going into the bottom of the 10th, it was 11-5 Giants. Carl Ferrillo led off with a single. Don Hoke singled, infield single, so it's first and second. George Shuba struck out swinging. Jim Gilliam, RBI single to center. So it's first and second. Pee Wee Reese walked to load the bases. New pitcher came in. Johnny Antonelli came in to pitch. Duke Snider walked to drive in Don Hoke. Gil Hodges struck out, so now there's 2 outs. Sandy Amoros singled to center to score Jim Gilliam and Pee Wee Reese, sending Duke Snider to second. Roy Campanella singled to center to score Duke Snider. And then Ruben Gomez replaces Johnny Antonelli as pitcher, and Burt Hamrick pinch runs for Roy Campanella at first base. It's now 11-10. The Dodgers have the tying run on second base, and Carl Ferrillo batting for the second time in the inning fouls out to third base to end the game. That was Burt Hamrick's major league debut. He came out, stood on first base, and then did nothing, stood there for 6 pitches. And then he got in one more game 4 days later as a pinch hitter, and he struck out. And that was the extent of his Dodgers career. He had 1 pinch hitting appearance and 1 pinch running appearance. And then he was out of the major leagues for 2 years. The Orioles took him in the Rule 5 draft. And in 1958, he had 8 plate appearances for the Orioles. 6 strikeouts in 8 plate appearances, and all as pinch hitters, and that was his career. For his career, he had 9 plate appearances, all as a pinch hitter, never played in the field, and struck out 7 of the 9 times, had 1 hit, batted 111, 111, 111, with a 78% strikeout rate, which is not good. And not surprisingly, he never played again. And he is our obscure former Dodger, Burt Hamrick.
I'm glad he got one hit at least.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just a single. Didn't drive in a run, never scored a run. Yeah, he had a OPS plus for his career of negative 37. Remember, with OPS plus, 100 is average. Zero is really bad. He was 37% worse than that. So, yeah, Burt Hamrick was not a good, very good ball player. And then he died August 8th, 1984, at the age of 56 in Springboro, Ohio. And he's kind of obscure. Whoa. His full name, his name's Burt, but his actual first name was Odbert. O-D-B-E-R-T. Odbert. Yeah, probably the only Odbert in Major League history. He's our obscure Odbert of the day.
This is the episode that's dedicated to him.
Yep, the Odbert episode. All right, now let's talk about less obscure guys like Martin McGuire and Sammy Sosa. On Sunday, ESPN aired their documentary going over the 1998 season, the home run chase between McGuire and Sosa. You watched it. I actually didn't. I was busy with stuff. Sunday was my son's birthday. I'm old enough to remember a lot about that season, so we thought we'd have a discussion about the 98 season. Where should we start, Vince?
Yeah, so it's called Long Gone Summer. It's on ESPN, still on like online or whatever if you want to watch it. For me, just going up based purely off the documentary, it wasn't groundbreaking. I didn't really learn anything new. It was, not... After watching the Michael Jordan documentary and other 30 for 30s where you feel like you learn things and they have really interesting people to interview, this one wasn't quite there for me. But yeah, the 98 season, so I was 7 years old, but that's really kind of the first memories I have of getting super into baseball. I was baseball in general. I was Dodgers, I knew Karros and Piazza and all those guys, obviously, and followed those Dodger teams. But I think this was the first year, other than Ken Griffey Jr., this was the first year where, other things drew me in. I remember specifically, playing outside during the summer and, if my dad's inside watching TV or ESPN or whatever it was, and they would cut away to McGuire or Sosa's at-bats, I'd run inside and watch the at-bat and, imitating Sosa's stance and hop when he hit the home run and his the kiss and the heart little celebration, imitating McGuire's swing. And I just as a kid, and that's really, like I said, where I first felt like I was into baseball as a whole and the MLB side rather than just like the Dodgers.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, I was 21 years old. I turned 21 that summer. I was a full-grown adult, and I had obviously grown up a Dodger fan, but I had watched a lot of Braves games growing up just because there were more Braves games on TV than Dodger games for me. But yeah, it was the first time that I found myself actually caring about a team that wasn't the Dodgers, or at least players who weren't on the Dodgers. The interaction between McGuire and Sosa that year was fun. Was Sosa on this documentary? Like, was there any new interviews with Sammy Sosa, recent ones?
Yeah, he was on it, but like I said, there wasn't really too much in depth from him or anything about it, but he was on it whenever they started doing this.
Because he has mostly disappeared from public view the last several years.
Yeah, they touched on the fact that, he hasn't been back to Wrigley since he left Chicago, and how they've kind of, kicked him to the curb, and basically as a whole too, like how McGuire and Sosa were kind of the biggest scapegoats for the steroid era, I guess.
Yeah. I was at the time, maybe I've talked about this before. I was a huge McGuire fan. And Sosa, I liked Sosa. I wasn't as impressed by Sosa because for me, like Sosa very clearly at the time seemed to be a product of steroids. McGuire hit 49 home runs as a rookie, and he was not nearly as big as he was later in his career. He was a tall, skinny-ish rookie when he hit 49 homers. So for me, I'm sure it doesn't hold hold water. The way, you know, 21, 22-year-olds think dumb things sometimes. But in my mind, McGuire was a power hitter who was using stuff to get better. And Sosa, I remembered Sammy Sosa coming up as a – what he was known for was his speed and his throwing arm. He was not a power hitter. And then he turned into this muscular monster hitting home runs. And so something about it at the time, even though I knew both of them were most likely doing about the same stuff, for whatever reason, and I don't think it was racism. I think it was just because McGuire had been a power hitter before. It's kind of the same way with Bonds. You know, Bonds was a power hitter already, and he used the steroids to go to the next level. I guess, you know, when I get down to it, if I had a Hall of Fame vote, I would be much more inclined to vote for Barry Bonds and Mark McGuire than I would for Sammy Sosa, just because Sosa seemed to be a product of steroids more than the other two.
Yeah, for me, you know, Sosa kind of came out of nowhere. I probably didn't know him, who he was the year before. So, you know, he kind of burst onto the scene, and he had everything we would want, you know, the smile, the energy, the, you know, the little hop and the, like I said, the little kissing and the where he would say hi to his mom. So he was, you know, fun for me. You know, just the 98 season as a whole, though, I mean, you run through what kind of happened. You had it became Sosa and McGuire, but it started with Griffey and McGuire, and then Sosa had 20 home runs in the month of June, and then he entered the race, and Griffey, you know, Griffey still had 56 home runs that year, but, you know, he wasn't anywhere near the leaderboard. The Yankees, which, not a fan of them, but they won 114 games. That was the first year of the Devil Rays and the Diamondbacks. The Brewers moved from the AL to the NL. You know, you had Kerry Wood striking out 20 players. You had a bunch of guys hitting home runs, I think there was four players that hit over 50 that year. I think Andrew Jones maybe was up there as well, or someone else. But, and then
wouldn't have been Jones.
Maybe Greg Vaughn, I think, was the other one, or somebody else. But either way, you know, the Marlins, who won the World Series in 97, won 54 games the next year. It was just, you know, there was a lot going on. And especially for me as a Dodger fan that year, I mean, that's the year Piazza got traded. So, you know, May 15th, Piazza gets traded. And now you're like, oh, well, my favorite player just got traded. But luckily for me, I was able to, you know, hop on all these other things. You know, Griffey had me early on, but then Sosa McGuire became the thing. And yeah, I mean, that it's always talked about as kind of the year that brought back baseball. And in the, you know, grand scope of things, I'm assuming for a lot of people it did after the strike in 94. Like, I was never really, you know, I was too young to realize all that stuff at that time. So for me, like I said, it was me more stepping into the game of MLB, or, you know, the league MLB, rather than just a Dodger fan.
Yeah, I was back immediately after the strike. I was counting the days for the strike to end, and as soon as it was over, I was back. But yeah, there were a lot of people who it took them a while to come back. You know, late 95 started to bring some people back when Cal Ripken broke Lou Gehrig's record. But yeah, 98 really was kind of the time when baseball became kind of the national conversation again. It was, everybody was talking about it in a good way. And even, you know, it was during that summer that a reporter spotted the Andro in Mark McGuire's locker. And it was, I mean, the reporter who spotted it was almost blackballed for daring to sully the great name of baseball and what was going on. And it's funny how the tide turned later. I don't know. I still get so conflicted all the time about how to feel about that, because, you know, it's one of those things that was technically against the rules, but not explicitly against the rules. And definitely, like, the Andro that McGuire, that we know McGuire was using, wasn't against any rules yet then. But, you know, I think later he admitted to using actual steroids that were both against the rules and illegal. But, you know, you kind of alluded to it, that they've kind of been made the scapegoats. They've been blackballed when they weren't nearly the only ones doing it. They were the most visible ones and the ones we know about. But I sometimes wonder how many people were using steroids that year, that and those years, that, you don't even hear about. You know, we've seen D. Gordon get popped for steroids, you know. It's not just the big muscular guys. And I remember in early 2000s, Buster Olney writing that he believed that 75% of the award winners during the steroid era were using steroids. And I tried to break that down because, you know, what he meant by award winners, if he was just talking Cy Young and MVP. And even then, I mean, the only way to get to 75% is to include a lot of guys who it really wouldn't make sense. But I do think the number was pretty darn high. And, you know, it doesn't make it right, but it maybe changes things a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always, I guess, not really conflicted. It's just that in that moment, it would, you know, there's no way I was going to be able to comprehend that. And even now, looking back, you know, you can't transport yourself back even as much as video and interviews and things that have happened since then. You really can't transport yourself back and, you know, figure out how you would feel about it. You know, at that point, like I said, it wasn't really banned. You know, they weren't testing for this stuff. So, you know, some people used it, some people didn't. Regardless of all that, you know, baseball was fun for me, and that's kind of how I have to take it as a kid approach, is that, you know, Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa weren't just breaking records, they were destroying baseballs. Like, watching that documentary, I think that was probably the thing that kind of shocked me the most, is that they were hitting some bombs. And I tweeted this out, I felt like every guy that they were throwing either hung a pitch or threw a fastball right down the middle. So you know, just kind of the evolution of pitching as well. I mean, these guys weren't facing probably three or four relievers pumping 99, 100. I mean, obviously they weren't. So it was a little bit different time as to maybe why, you know, we're probably not going to see that ever again.
Yeah, although McGwire's bat was so big that, like, I mean, I think that thing had a sweet spot that was 2 feet long. So, you know, I think he could cover anything and maybe made some better pitches look worse just because of how much plate coverage he had or something.
It's possible, but it just looked like everything was hanging, or it didn't look like they were hitting pitchers' pitches.
Yeah, for sure. The Madison Bumgarner effect, that's what we call that. My favorite Sammy Sosa stat is that he is the only player in history to have 60-plus homers in three different seasons, and he led the league in homers two different times. But the two times he led the league in homers weren't any of the times that he hit 60-plus homers. All 3 years that he hit 60 homers, he had the second most homers in the league, twice to McGwire and once to Bonds. But, yeah, he led the league. He hit 60 homers in 98, 99, and 2001, and he led the league in homers in 2000 and 2002. So that cracks me up.
Yeah, that's interesting. And 1998 was the year I went to my first World Series game. In San Diego, yeah. So, 98, I guess, overall for me is one of those years where, you know, I definitely remember, and probably the first time I really have legit memories of, you know, actually watching things and seeing things in real time.
Yeah, that makes sense, because that's so you were 7 years old, right? Yeah, and that's my first memories really are 85 when I was 8. So the year I turned 8. So yeah, that's about right. And it's funny how young you are, I guess, is what I'm getting at, Vince.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense.
You're a child.
That's true.
Yeah, 98, it was a fun year, and it brought baseball back, and it's definitely viewed differently now through the lens of history. But you know, I'm still a big Mark McGwire fan. The moment you and I met, we were standing, 10 feet from Mark McGwire?
Yeah.
Yeah, when he was the Dodgers hitting coach.
Yeah, I was complaining that he kept stepping in my shot.
Yeah, and I was just I had to, like, back up because I heard him talking about Game of Thrones. Not Game of Thrones. I don't watch Game of Thrones. What's the other show? The Kevin Spacey show.
Oh, House of Cards?
House of Cards. He was talking to Jock Peterson about House of Cards. And I could tell he was about to spoil it for me, and I hadn't finished the season yet, so I had to back up so Mark McGwire didn't spoil House of Cards for me. And I remember how surreal that was, that this guy who I had loved watching play, even when he was on the A's, you know, in the 88 World Series, He was the only guy in the A's I couldn't bring myself to hate. And so, yeah, it was surreal that I was now having TV shows almost spoiled by that guy.
Oh, how the world works.
Yep. Yeah, you have any final thoughts on 1998, Vince?
No. Although, like I said, I wouldn't recommend the documentary if you remember most of what happened in 98. But if you don't remember, it's fun to watch, even just to watch all the home runs that they were hitting.
Yeah, for sure. All right, I think that'll do it for today then. Thank you all for listening to Locked On Dodgers. Please subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. If you have Apple Podcasts, even if you don't use it, go ahead and subscribe there. That helps other people find us. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about maybe some good news in baseball or maybe something else. But either way, we'll be here. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Locked On Dodgers. Vince is on Twitter at Vince Semperio. I'm on Twitter at Snydog. DMs are open on all of those, so shoot us questions, comments, concerns, love notes, whatever you want, anytime you want. Our email address is lockedondodgers@gmail.com. Our phone number for voicemail or text messages is 323-863-LOCK-5625. We are here every weekday morning, and we hope you'll be here with us. When you get in your car or sit on your couch, tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On Dodgers. And remember, you don't have to agree, you just have to listen. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
And now, tell your smart device to play the latest episode of Locked On MLB. Have a good one.
D. I say D-O. D-O-D-G-E-R-S. The team that's all heart, all heart and all thumbs, they're my Los Angeles. Your Los Angeles. Our Los Angeles. Do you think we'll really win the pennant? Bombs!